God aften og velkommen til Radio Shalom på 87,6 MHz på FM-båndet og på www.radioshalom.dk. Mit navn er Alexander Michtagslav. Vi skal i aften høre et foredrag af den kendte amerikanske rabbiner Shmuley Boteach. Shmuley Boteach er en stor samfundsdebattør og har skrevet flere end 30 bøger om forskellige emner, også religiøse, som for eksempel kosher sex og kosher Jesus. Han besøgte Chabad i København i november og gav et foredrag, hvor han forsøgte at indkredse årsager til, hvad der er ved os jøder, som verden ikke kan lide, hvad er kilden til antisemitismen, og hvordan det kan være, at selv efter Holocaust er verden endnu ikke holdt op med at begå folkedrab. Foredraget er på engelsk. Shmuley Boteach introduceres kort af Chabads københavnske rabbiner Itzi Löwenthal. Præsentationen munder ud i en fødselsdagssang, da det var Shmuley Boteachs fødselsdag den dag. God fornøjelse.
Shmuley and his wife Debbie, who have taken the trouble to and the time out to come and share of his wisdom here. Now, the truth be told is, I believe that Rabbi Shmuley has written over 30 books, including but not limited to kosher sex, the Jewish guide to adultery, and some other books. So for those, you're gonna have to go online and buy the books, right? You always put it in, it helps
to get the crowd
to people to listen. Okay, it also but at the same, and in addition to his various work, he had or still has a TV show, Shalom in the Home, right? Bringing harmony between couples, and he has been in many ways definitely a light onto the nation, which means not only among the Jews, but also showing how Jewish ideas and ideals can be presented to the world at large, including some characters who might be considered, well, I'm not going to give a judgmental opinion on Michael Jackson and other personalities like that, who Shmuley was their personal rabbi.
Guru.
So the, but as such, he also defends Israel very strongly, very ardently. We're living in Denmark and in Scandinavia and in Europe and in the world at large, where anti-Semitism is a real issue. Just last week, we had some anti-Semitic incidents here. And actually, I was just today at a meeting where somebody made an important point, which was is that the people, the individuals that were targeted, actually some of them were not Jews, but they were targeted because of their support of Israel. Some of them were Jews, but others were non-Jews who were supported because of their targeted because of their support of Israel. So Israel, anti-Semitism, Judaism, they all go together. We say a big thank you to Shmuley, for Rabbi Shmuley, for coming and taking his time. And I think what we shall do is, like every good speech, is that he'll give the talk for however long he does. If you really get bored, you fall asleep. If you snore loudly, he'll probably get the message. And then at the end, I'm sure he'll take questions and discussion. But I think let's leave that to the end. It might not be the end. It might be the beginning of something more exciting. It's been scientifically proven that birthdays are very healthy for you. And today is also Rabbi Shmuley's birthday. So we are going to sing for him. Happy birthday. Please bring it in.
Day and Shmuley's birthday. Hurrah, hurrah, hurrah. So big hands I and gave us some hand on skesai. Oh, medaili shokolele, okay. So skal han hjem og holde fest, og dem som kommer min som get dejlig chokolade og kære til.
I must point out, as much as I love you, it was your wife that orchestrated it.
Well, you know, that is not exactly the happy birthday song that I'm accustomed to.
No.
It's Danish. And I'm not even sure you were actually singing about my birthday.
Oh, okay. He found out.
I'm beginning to suspect you were singing "How long's he gonna speak? We're going home." But okay, that sounded birthday like. Sorry, but thank you very much. I'm
very good.
I'm very, very grateful. Do I get to keep this? Do I have to give it back? Is it
a
prop?
You have to give it back.
Is it like a prop?
You can eat it.
Prop.
Okay.
We can sing a regular happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Thank you.
Happy birthday, dear Julie.
Happy birthday
to you.
Thank you very much. Debbie?
You're the redhead.
Okay.
This is for a cute redhead, and I said, "Well, she can cheat. There's room."
Okay. Now that my hands are all sticky, thank you all very much for coming out on a cold and rainy night. But cold and rainy is basically par for the course here in Copenhagen, right? So you don't get any special credit, is my understanding. It is my birthday, but I should mention that, thank God, we Jews get two birthdays. So we have our Gregorian birthday, which follows the solar calendar, and that's my birthday today, November 19th. I've always been very proud of November 19th, because on the American calendar, it's the day that the most famous speech in American history was given. It's the day that Lincoln gave the Gettysburg Address, November 19th, 1863. And I actually went to Gettysburg, and I wanted to find exactly where he gave the speech. I love great oratory. I love great speeches. Mm-hmm. And no one knows exactly where he gave it, so I had to guess. My Jewish birthday is the seventh day of Kislev. So it's actually, there's like a 3-week. So now I get to build up towards the second birthday. I'll be back in Copenhagen for that, too. I expect a much bigger cake, God willing. I could think of a few things, and by the way, I'm wearing AirPods, because this is on Facebook and it'll just help the audio if it actually works. I could think of a few things that I would find more rewarding on my birthday, and I'm here with my wife Debbie, who's accompanied me from the United States, than to speak to a Jewish community like here in Copenhagen. I have found myself very often speaking on my birthday. Why, I don't know. But it's such a rewarding thing. Having been the rabbi at Oxford University for 11 years, where the Lubavitcher Rebbe sent me, and where Rabbi Yitzi's brother-in-law now runs Chabad, I could really appreciate the importance of smaller communities and keeping Jewish tradition alive and keeping Jewish identity alive, and how challenging it is. But I left. So we lived in Western Europe for 11 years. I was the Rebbe Shliach in Oxford, but that was 20 years ago. This past October marked 20 years since I left Western Europe. But I visit Europe constantly, several times a year, and I speak in European communities. And of course, there's been a tremendous change, even back in that, from those days. The Rebbe sent me to Oxford in 1988. We arrived around Hanukkah 1988. And that year was special or unique on the Israeli calendar and Israeli history, because it was the year that George W. Shultz, the United States Secretary of State, pressed Yasser Arafat to recognize Israel's right to exist. Like every other nation just gets to exist, we have to be recognized as having a right to exist. So Arafat, with all of his deep sincerity, recognized Israel's right to exist. So that meant that for the first time, PLO speakers could be invited to Western universities. So I was right there when all the pro-Palestinian speakers started coming onto Western campuses. I remember January 1989, if I remember correctly, it was Bassem Abu Sharif. He was Yasser Arafat's chief spokesperson. So we thought that the Arab PLO speakers were going to come to give speeches of conciliation and peace. Nothing could have been further from the truth. I sat there listening to a speech at the Oxford Union, and I was just in shock. So we responded by bringing six Israeli prime ministers to speak at Oxford. We had Prime Minister Netanyahu twice. We had We had Rabin, Shamir, Perez, Olmert, and scores of other Israeli ministers, pro-Israel speakers. So I was the first to see these battles, and we were battled by the Oxford Middle East Society, by the Oxford Islamic Society, but it was very civil. We used to help the Arab students get their halal meat. It was kosher meat, but they could eat halal meat. The Islamic community at Oxford at the time was very, very small. And at our Shabbat table, we had the grandson of the King of Saudi Arabia who used to come here, Holocaust speakers. His sister today is the new Saudi ambassador in Washington. He was the son of Prince Bandar, who was the Saudi ambassador in Washington for, I don't know, 30 years, almost three decades. Now his daughter's taken over. We had the son of the Jordanian ambassador to the court of St. James. He was a regular at our Shabbat table. And interestingly, one of the people who brought some of these Arab students was Ron Dermer, our student president, who today is Israel's ambassador in Washington, D.C. Some of our other student presidents included people like Senator Cory Booker, who's now running for the presidency of the United States. Oxford at the time was, there were great battles for Israel and the Jewish people, but overt anti-Semitism, shouting down Israeli speakers, making it impossible for them to speak. Fast forward to like 3 years ago, I went with my wife on Thanksgiving, so it was November, to Oxford where we had a debate about whether Hamas or Israel is responsible for fighting in the Middle East, and we just saw the Hamas rockets attacking Israel. Now, you would think that at a world-renowned university, the question of whether a terror-funding, a terrorist death cult that engages in honor killings of innocent Palestinian women, whose only crime is to have a boyfriend. You would think that Hamas, that murders LGBTQ Palestinians, Hamas, which is funded by Qatar, by Iran, that you would think that Hamas, which doesn't have a scintilla of democracy, and where any kind of political protest on the part of Palestinians is responded to by people being machine gunned to death, there would be no question as to who is the righteous player in this debate about the Jewish state of Israel. Israel, the only democracy in the Middle East. Israel, the only place where women have rights in the Middle East. Israel, where my friend Amir Ohana just became the Israeli justice minister. He's openly gay. We honored him at a dinner 2 years ago. He's a great Israeli patriot. He's the fourth or fifth most powerful minister in the entire government, or if not higher. And he's openly gay. The idea of this happening in Iran or Syria or Saudi Arabia or UAE or Lebanon or Egypt, these are impossibilities, obviously. So you would have thought that there could be no debate. But not only was there a debate, but at this Oxford Union debate, which you can watch online, we had... We had a British female student calling Israel the Gestapo, Nazis, the SS. We had an Israeli academic named Avi Shlaim, one of the world's leading experts in international relations, who served in the IDF in the 1967 Six-Day War, but has been at Oxford for decades since. He actually got up and said that Israel is responsible for the longest occupation in all of the Middle East. Sorry, longest occupation in the entire world. So I got up. You're allowed to do a point of information at Oxford. So I got up and I said, point of information, you're a world-renowned Oxford historian, and did you just say that Israel is responsible for the longest... Even if we say that Israel's occupying Judea and Samaria, and we'll talk all about that tonight, especially in light of the announcement by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo yesterday, said even if you say that Israel's absolutely occupying Yehuda and Shomron in the West Bank, China has been occupying Tibet since 1951, and nobody gives a damn. And then I said to all the students there, how many of you are using iPhones right now? They're all made in China. Look at what's been happening in Hong Kong the past few days. Look at water cannons and tear gas.
Real bullets.
And rubber bullets. Let's hope it's not. Let's hope it doesn't turn into real bullets against Hong Kong students. Has anyone seen one Chinese product boycotted? I mean, the hypocrisy, let alone Russia's illegal occupation of Crimea, Turkey's illegal occupation of northern Cyprus since 1975. I could go on, But the singling out of Israel, and they always say it's because of an occupation. Let's just remember, Yudan, Shomron, Judea, and Samaria, which is now in the news, because just yesterday at about this time, I was sitting here, actually in the restaurant downstairs, when we heard the news that Secretary Pompeo had announced that the United States was going to reverse the Obama-era policy of treating Israeli settlements as illegal. And that could be in response to the ruling by the European Court of Justice, the ECJ, on November 12th, where they said that all settlements, including the Golan Heights, including East Jerusalem, that means including Jews praying at the Kotel, are illegal in international law, and that all Jewish products have to be labeled. We all know what labeling of Jewish products, what that means. No one knows that better than Europeans. iPhones are not labeled. It could be that the United States enacted that policy in response to the EU. But let's just remember what they mean by an occupation. This little piece of land, Yudan Shomron, Judea and Samaria, was part of the British mandate set up by the League of Nations after the First World War. Before that, of course, it was all controlled by the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire dissolved. So the British had a mandate, which is just a legal term, which really meant it was a colony. It was treated as a British colony. Well, the British had enough because the Jews and the Arabs were fighting so much, and it turned out that keeping this colony was not worth their while. So they turn it back to the UN. The UN votes in November 1947, to partition. The UN decides that they vote to partition Palestine. Jordan immediately goes and grabs Judea and Samaria. It was not Jordanian. It was part of the British mandate. It was Palestine. And they illegally occupied it because only three countries recognized Jordanian control of the West Bank. And then by the way, it's a really interesting word, two words to use, West Bank. The West Bank of the Jordan River. Who's ever heard of a giant piece of land actually referred to as the West Bank? Like, it's like saying that California is the West Bank of the Mississippi. It's a little bit ridiculous. It's especially true when the Jordan River is about as wide as this whole table. You can like jump over the Jordan River. The Jordan River is one of the most famous yet least impressive rivers in the entire world. But the whole thing is just the West Bank of the Jordan River. Then in 1967, of course, King Hussein decides to start shelling Jerusalem. Israel is fighting for its life against Egypt and Syria, and the Israelis send a message. They had many conduits to King Hussein. They say to him, don't attack us, we're not going to attack you. But he is believing all the garbage coming out of Nasser of Egypt's mouth that he's already in Tel Aviv, he's pushing his way to Haifa. So King Hussein thinks, I also want some Jewish land. So he attacks Israel. Israel responds in a defensive war, and now Israel controls Yudan Shomron until this very day. But what are these lands? These are the lands where 80% of all biblical events take place. You have to remember that. These are the lands where this week's Torah reading about where Sarah is buried. These are the lands where Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Sarah, Rebecca, and Leah are all buried. These are the lands where King David was crowned the first Jewish king. These are the lands where for 369 years the tabernacle at Shiloh stood. This is the place of Eli, Beit El. 80% of the Bible takes place in what is being in this disputed territory. So even if you want to say it's disputed, when the European Court of Justice, which is the Supreme Court of the EU, rules that we're going to single out Israel, there are right now 180 territorial disputes going on around the world. We're going to only single out the Jews. We're going to punish their businesses. We're going to make people feel guilty whenever you buy dates or olives or a bottle of wine from Yudan Shomron. We're going to label and say this is an illegal Israeli settlement. So then any of you who buy it are going to feel really bad about it. But you know what my concern is? Okay, if Israel has to live without Europeans buying their dates and other products and wine from Israel, will survive. But you know what really worries me? I think all of this increases anti-Semitism in Europe. Because I think, you know, the word, the most important anti-Semitic word used to be capitalist, banker, Bolshevik. Give me more. But you know the word is now. The word now is occupier. thief.
A fine car.
So when we lived in Europe for 2,000 years, they basically said to us, you can't own land, which is why we became bankers, or we lent money and interest, because every other profession was closed to us. Europe is not your land, Jews. You're not even allowed to be a farmer. You can't own any land. Go back to Israel. And as soon as we went back to Israel, they said, you just stole the land from the Palestinians and the Arabs. Where are we supposed to live? On the moon? We're the only nation state that is not allowed to have any place to live. Wherever we, and that's why you know it's motivated by anti-Semitism, because all of these arguments cancel each other out. So what I want to do tonight, after that little overview about what the Israel haters say they hate Israel for, the occupation of Yudan, Sharmon, Judea, and Samaria, what I want to do tonight is, I want to take a deep breath, and I want to go back. I want to go way back. I want to go to the beginning. I want to ask, why the Jews? Why do they hate us? Why is there growing anti-Semitism around the world? You know, I really believed with all my heart that after the Holocaust, and I am a deep student of the Holocaust, I've just written a 700-page book on the Holocaust that took me the past 3 years to write. But it wasn't the writing that was excruciating. It was the fact that the book is called Holocaust Holiday, One Family's Descent into Genocide Memory Hell. The book is based on 3 summers of my take, and we have 9 children, thank God, most of our kids, to the killing fields of Europe, in Poland, and the Czech Republic, and Slovakia, where my wife's family was murdered, Michalovce, Košice, and then we went to Hungary and Italy. I mean, if there was a speck of Holocaust memory, or a ditch where they shot the Jews, or a gas chamber, or an extermination camp where they murdered the Jews, if it was Mauthausen, Sachsenhausen, Auschwitz, Birkenau, the Łódź ghetto, the Warsaw ghetto, we went to these places. And the book is about the impact on the children and the impact on our family as I tell the story of the Holocaust. And I said to my kids, who thought that I was really overdoing it, you know, it's one thing they said, you want to go on the March of the Living for 10 days and we visit some of these horrible places, but then you go to Israel, it's inspirational. But 3 summers in a row, and I said to my children, I believe with all my heart that the 6 million want to be remembered. I'm a deep student of the Holocaust. I was very close to Elie Wiesel, who I considered a teacher and a mentor. I did many public speeches with Elie Wiesel. I started hosting him at Oxford 30 years ago. I called him affectionately Reb Eliezer, and he called me Reb Shmuel. I miss him very much. I'm blessed to be very close to his wife and his son till today. He died on the 2nd of January, 2016. We wrote a Torah in his memory, a Torah this big, and I took it with us on the trip. And the Torah, we finished the Torah when Elisha Wiesel, his only son, said the last Kaddish for Elie Wiesel. We did a big dinner with about 1,000 people in New York City. He said the last Kaddish. We finished you can see the pictures on Google, they're very moving. Mm-hmm. President Paul Kagame of Rwanda came for the dinner because, of course, Rwanda had a genocide in 1994. So I asked the question, why us? What is it about us that they just don't like us? And I never thought, after the Holocaust, I really never believed that this stuff could happen again. I'm not talking about gas chambers, thank God, God forbid, we're not there. But I never thought that there would be army camps outside of shuls here in Copenhagen, and soldiers armed to the hilt. My God, I visited the Jewish day school in Brussels about a year ago at about midnight with the rabbi of the community. He wanted to show it to me. And he's the rabbi of the community, and you should have seen the police grilling him. It was an army camp, barbed wire, everything. Jewish kids going to school in Europe in schools surrounded by barbed wire. I never thought that we would see 11 Jews murdered in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The United States is a country that has no history of institutionalized anti-Semitism, thank God. I never thought that we'd see a Chabad rabbi's fingers blown off in Poway, California, a woman murdered. I never thought that we would see someone arrested just 2 weeks ago in Colorado for planning to blow up a shul. I really thought that after the Holocaust, the non-Jewish world would scare itself into, oh my God, what have we done? Like, kol d'mei achicha tzorkim alai min ha'adama, the blood of your brother cries out to me from the earth, that God would look at the non-Jewish nations and say, what have you done? And God would say to himself, what have I allowed to be done? God watched all this. And I thought this could really never happen again. And here we are 75 years later. 65% of Americans have never heard of Auschwitz, according to the New York Times. Antisemitism in Europe is growing. So many Jews in Europe, and here I am speaking to a European Jewish community, don't believe there's any future. I was the rabbi at Oxford just 20 years ago. And now Jeremy Corbyn is about to debate Boris Johnson. And this is not a political statement. I actually met Boris Johnson because he was a features writer for the Telegraph. And he wrote a feature on me. And so I met him when he wrote this feature. But when I was living at Oxford, Tony Blair was the head of the Labour Party. And his brother William was such a close friend of the Jewish community, he used to come to our house for Shabbos dinner. Tony Blair's Christian brother William. And then Tony Blair converted to Catholicism. Great friend of Israel. I may not agree with all his policies, but great friend of Israel. And 20 years later, we're about to have possibly an outright and unapologetic anti-Semite who praises Hamas as our friends, goes to memorial services for the killers of the 1972 11 Israeli athletes. I mean, this stuff boggles the imagination, and it's the new normal, and we're not even surprised at it because it's so common. And God almighty, is this all real? That you can't wear a yarmulke in Copenhagen? Okay. People think you can't. I agree with you, but I don't live here. And whose achrayus, whose responsibility is going to be if you tell someone, no, it's okay. And then they get beat up or something. I don't know. Of course we should be proud Jews. Of course we should wear kippot. But the belief that you can't, 75 years after the Holocaust, this is just shocking. So we have to answer the question, why the Jews? And then there's one more thing we have to answer. We have to answer, why did the killing never stop? The Holocaust was the largest genocide ever perpetrated. Not just the number, 6 million, but also it was the only continent-wide genocide ever attempted and perpetrated by any country. I've studied genocide. The amazing and shocking thing about the Holocaust is not just the number, the method of death, the disease, the typhoid, the starvation. God almighty, we actually went into the Ringelblum archive in Warsaw, where you see the death cards of the first 40, 50,000 people who died in the ghetto, and you have physicians writing on the back, death by starvation. And you actually see it, death, whoever sees a card that says death by starvation. But the really shocking thing about the Holocaust for me when I wrote this book, and researching the book over 3 years, summer after summer, was the scope of it, a continent-wide genocide. I remember we went to Majdanek. Majdanek's the worst of the camps to visit, because Majdanek was captured by the Soviets, and the Germans had no plan to destroy the ovens. They were under strict orders from Himmler to destroy the ovens, as they did at Auschwitz. We're about to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz by the Red Army on January 27th, 1945. And all the death camp, all the crematoria, with the exception of the first of Crematoria 1 and Auschwitz 1, which wasn't the extermination camp, it was the labor camp, they were all destroyed. But Majdanek, the Red Army hooked around, came and captured Lublin. So the Germans had no time to destroy it. So it's the only camp where you actually see gas chambers, the crematoria, and you see a mound 10 times the size of this room of skulls, bones, ash, in a giant mound. And a lot of rabbis believe it should have been buried out of dignity, and that's probably what the halacha is, but I actually believe they have to keep it just the way it is, because it's horrible enough for people to understand what the Holocaust was. So, but we're in Lublin, Majdanek. We have to drive the entire night to go to Slovakia, where my wife's family was murdered. It was the worst drive. We're driving in the middle of the night on a terrible road. It's raining. My wife is driving. It's a 7-hour drive going over the mountains that separate Slovakia from Poland, southern Poland. And trucks coming right at us. I don't know if we were going to survive the drive. And then after all of that, we finally get there and we're so relieved, only to discover that the place that we arrived at 7 hours later, they also killed all the Jews. Everywhere you went, you go to Amsterdam, they killed all the Jews. You go to Paris, the Parisian authorities, the French collaborationists, they deported 80,000 Jews. The French deported 80,000 Jews, not the Germans. You go to Greece, they killed 90% of the Jews. Poland, 90% of the Jews. I know this country is different. We'll talk about that too. It's a miracle. But the scope of it. So the first question is, why do they hate us? And the second question we have to answer is, how did the killing not stop? After a continent-wide genocide, how is it that there was still, 30 years later, the Cambodian genocide, 3.5 million murdered by Pol Pot and the Khmer Rouge. The Rwandan genocide, 880,000 killed in just 3 months. That was the fastest mass murder in human history. No gas chambers, low tech.
Which one?
Rwanda. No gas chambers, no machine guns. It's all a low tech killing with machetes. So many people died that the bodies dammed the rivers in Rwanda. The river ceased to flow because of human bodies. And one of the great honors of my life is that I was the keynote speaker at Amahoro National Stadium for the 20th anniversary of the Rwanda genocide at the invitation of President Kagame. And we Jews, we have two Holocaust memorial days. One is the UN, that's the International Holocaust Remembrance Day, that's January 27th. But it's not what the Jews really celebrate, because we want to commemorate the day the Jews fought back. So our Yom HaShoah follows the calendar of Mordechai and Alevich's uprising in the Warsaw Ghetto. So it's around, and that was second night of Pesach, the second Seder. We can't do it on Pesach. So it's a week after Pesach. But we have two Holocaust Remembrance Days, but we don't scream and cry. It's somber. If you go to Israel, there's moments of silence, all the traffic stops. In Rwanda, the people in the stadium, they're all screaming. It's something you can't imagine what it's even like. First of all, the Holocaust was only 25 years ago. So most of these people are survivors. Everyone's a survivor. If you're a Tutsi, you're a survivor. But 330 were killed every single hour for 3 months. But it didn't end there, because then you had at least two genocides in the former Yugoslavia, Kosovo, Srebrenica. Then you had Darfur. Now you have Syria, 600,000-700,000 dead. And that kind of meets the technical definition of a genocide, because you have an Alawite regime, Assad, partnering with a terrorist Shia regime in Iran that wants to slaughter the Sunnis. And he's using other Shia militias like Hezbollah. And the definition of a genocide is where you seek to annihilate an ethnicity. And he actually used poison, mustard, sarin, gas. And the only person who punished him, because the UN didn't even pass a single resolution against him, was when President Trump fired 59 Tomahawk missiles at him. But otherwise, he's completely gotten away with this. So those are the two questions. Why do they hate us, the Jews? And secondly, how is it that after the Holocaust, mass murder has been so common throughout the world, where we barely bat an eyelash when we hear about massive, I mean, like Syria, shocking, and nobody cares? So my friends,
people care, they're just desensitized.
Well, caring and doing something about it. And so I was not born in a Mount Sinai hospital. I was actually born in a Cedars of Lebanon hospital in Los Angeles, California. But right near where I grew up in Miami Beach, Florida, there's a giant Mount Sinai. And right near where we live, where the World Values Network headquarters is in New York, we have a giant Mount Sinai hospital. And it's probably the most common name of hospitals in the United States. And people would be really surprised if they knew what the word actually means. What does Mount Sinai mean? Anyone know? What does the word Sina mean in Hebrew?
Hate.
Yeah, who said that? Hatred. So what's Har Sinai, Mount Sinai, what does it mean? Mountain of hatred. I mean, you can imagine the board of directors of all these hospitals. By the way, do you realize that we're called the Mountain of Hatred Hospital? The Talmud actually asks, what a strange name of the mountain where the Torah is given. God is a God of love. Lama Nikra Shmo Sinai. Why was it called Mount Sinai? And the Talmud says, very insightfully, Mishum Shemisham Yarda Sina Le'olam. Because from there at Mount Sinai, hatred descended onto the entire world, onto the Jewish people from the entire world. Let me repeat that. Why was it called Mount Sinai? Because when God gave the Jewish people the Torah, anti-Semitism began, and the whole world began to hate the Jews. And why did the whole world begin to hate the Jews? Because the Jews were entrusted at Mount Sinai with spreading a message of do not murder, do not steal, do not commit adultery, don't be jealous, don't covet. You're not God, so don't pretend to be God. You don't make the rules of right and wrong. You have to subject yourself to the absolute morality of God's law contained in these commandments. How is the world going to react to it? A nation preaching that message? How are they going to react to a nation preaching to them about being moral? Answer?
By telling us that we're killing children in Gaza.
The answer is that they would try to kill the messenger. Nobody wants a conscience. Even us people who are good moral people, we also don't like having a conscience. Not always. That's why we often drink to the point of drunkenness so we can forget our conscience. It's why we sometimes binge watch television instead of, I don't know, having dinner with our kids, going and visiting our parents, being a good friend. Because if you kill your conscience through constant all manners of escape, then you don't have to feel bad about anything you're doing, either sins of commission, bad things you're doing, or sins of omission, the good things that you are failing to do. The root cause of anti-Semitism is the Jewish people as the conscience of the world.
Value envy.
Why was it called the Mountain of Hatred? Because the world started to hate the Jews when they carried forth this message of the Ten Commandments. By the way, it's just so true. Look at Israel. I'm telling you, if Israel was more like the Arab dictatorships that surround it, if Israel just mowed down protesters, if Israel just didn't let women drive a car or stone them to death, not when women commit adultery. Remember in Iran, they don't stone you to death when you commit adultery. They stone you to death when your husband accuses you of adultery because he wants to get rid of you. And a woman in Iran who's accused of adultery, the burden of proof is on her to prove that she did not commit adultery because her husband would not lie. And when she is stoned to death, like this famous story of Soraya M. that was witnessed by a French journalist firsthand, it's her male issue, her sons who have to throw the first stones. And of course, you know, she's dug into a pit with her arms locked and she's stoned to death. If Israel was more like that, I bet you it would not be as hated by many of its Arab neighbors. Because being such a moral beacon in the Middle East makes all of them look terrible. They're now judged by Western free democratic standards because Israel practices all of those values, these Judeo-Christian values in the Middle East, where its Arab neighbors say it could never prosper. Whenever we came before, during the days of Henry Kissinger, say, whenever we came to, I don't know, Egypt or Syria, every time the United States went to its allies, Saudi Arabia, and said, you're not letting women drive? Are you kidding me? You're cutting people's head off or their hands when they steal? This is barbarity. You're whipping women in public when they take off their abaya? Are you kidding me? Their response always was, no. You must be kidding me. You're stupid enough to think that this is Kansas or this is Malibu. This is the Middle East. Our citizens are a bunch of animals. And the only way we can keep them in check is through brutality. Saddam Hussein, that was his argument. You take me out, you're going to see Iraq go to hell. And President George W. Bush famously said, this is the soft bigotry of low expectations. This is the biggest insult to Arabs ever. That Arabs don't want to be free? That Arabs aren't the same as every American? As every Dane? As every Swede? As every Frenchman or woman? That they're not equal children of God? That they don't yearn to be free? That they don't want human rights? That they can only live? That's why the whole Western world abandoned the Arab Spring. The Arab Spring was the first opportunity to bring real human rights and Western democratic values. And we all ran from it, thinking, oh my God, we opened a Pandora's box. Hamas was elected in a democratic election. Morsi of Egypt, of the Muslim Brotherhood, was elected in a democratic election. Enough elections! Give us the dictators back! Israel makes its Arab brothers and sisters look really bad with a flourishing democracy. And if you don't think that Israel's a flourishing democracy or flourishing media, all the scandals that Prime Minister Netanyahu, who I've known for 3 decades, and who I personally appreciate him very much, I think he's done a very good job for Israel, you may feel differently, but I have to tell you, a lot of the scandals he's mired in right now are about him going to press editors and begging them, can you write one nice thing about me or my wife? Meaning, Israel is so free with its media that you can attack the most powerful man in the country every single day, and he's reduced to a supplicant. Please write something nice about me. Because in an Arab government, that editor, no one would be begging him. He would be in jail or he'd have no head by now. But not in Israel, which is a democracy with a free press and an independent judiciary. So why do they hate Israel? For those of you who say, but these are such lies. Israel's the only democracy. How could Western liberal countries, how could governments like Sweden attack Israel so much? It doesn't make any sense. Israel's the most moral. It's because it's the most moral. It is its morality that makes so many of its Arab brothers and sisters want to defame it and say, oh yes, they talk a good game, these Israelis. They talk a good game. But what they're really doing is secretly or overtly engaging in genocide against the Palestinians. This is all a front. They're just a bunch of Nazis. Because the way you kill a conscience is to either kill it outright, but if you try and you can't because the conscience has, I don't know, built itself an army after 2,000 years and now they're too strong, you defame it. You destroy their moral credibility. This way, if Hamas is correct that Israel's perpetrating a genocide against Palestinians in Gaza, then no one's going to complain when Hamas slaughters any Palestinian who expresses dissent against Hamas authoritarian rule. But if Israel isn't doing that, and Israel is saying, God Almighty, we gave you this territory, this land, to build something prosperous, and you now receive per capita more Western aid than the Marshall Plan, triple the Marshall Plan per capita. And what have you done with the money? You've bought bullets and bombs and built bunkers and tunnels to kill people. Where are the hospitals? Hamas's answer is, what can we do? We have to defend ourselves against these Gestapo Israeli Jewish Nazis that are trying to kill us. Would anyone blame Mordechai Analevich for having built bunkers in the Warsaw Ghetto to stop the Nazis coming after him? That's the essence of the defamation. And that's why defamation of Israel, especially on the part of the EU, it keeps the Arabs back. It's actually a tragedy for the Arabs. Because if one country can be acknowledged as democratic and human rights upholding and moral in the Middle East, then all countries will be judged by that standard. And then Arab citizens will finally have the rights that Arab citizens will find in Arab countries will finally have the rights that Arab citizens in Israel have. And by the way, for those who say that Israel's an apartheid state, Arabs have more rights than Jews in Israel. Because the one thing Arab citizens of Israel, of which there are 1.5 million, that's 20% of the population, 1.5 million Muslim citizens is as many as Britain has, and Britain has a population of more than 70 million. Arabs have more rights because they're not drafted into the army. They don't have to go and fight. And for those of you who think that's not a big deal, my country, the United States, was torn asunder over conscription during Vietnam. That was the issue that ripped the fabric of the entire nation apart. That some people were not being drafted, namely white kids who were going to universities, and it was poor black kids who were going to the jungles of Vietnam. And even now, the reason why Israel has no government is that Avigdor Lieberman is telling Netanyahu, you better tell your Haredi allies that unless their boys go to the army, I'm not joining any government with them. And the Haredim respond, somebody has to learn Torah. Well, who's right? We can debate this, but I'm showing you that the issue of forced conscription is usually the issue that tears a country apart. And Arabs are not drafted into the army. And all the Jewish boys, except if they're Haredim, have to serve. And now increasingly there are more Haredim who are serving. By the way, we're an Orthodox Jewish family, me and my wife. And we're an American family. And two of our children serve in the IDF. And we're very proud of their service. So Israel is hated because it's good. Because. And that explains, you know, the ultimate question. Why is it that the country which is the most moral and the most just in the Middle East gets the most criticism? That's the entire reason. They have to defame it. They have to make it look bad, because otherwise all of its neighbors are going to have to explain why they're not practicing the same kind of human rights, same kind of freedoms. It's funny. 6 of my 9 children were born in Europe. We're an American family, but 6 of our 9 children were born in Europe. I don't think my European brethren understand that their attacks in Israel, on Israel, their bias against Israel, just how bad this is for the Arabs. So that's the reason for anti-Semitism, and it's kind of really unfair when you think about it. It's like my biggest complaint I have to God. We just read in the Torah that Abraham objects to God, and he teaches us the whole art of Jewish defiance. God says that the inhabitants of Sodom and Gomorrah are going to be destroyed. And you would expect Abraham, as a good religious Jew, to bow his head in silent submission. The word Islam means submit, for example. Christianity, Soren Kierkegaard. Good place to quote Kierkegaard. Famously said that religion is about a leap of faith. You just kind of have to blindly accept it. But Abraham doesn't do that. He objects to God, and he says, Ashofet kol oros layasa mishpat, will a judge of the entire earth not practice justice? So sometimes I want to look at God and I want to say, it's kind of weird, very unfair. You tell the Jewish people they have to spread the Ten Commandments, then they get slaughtered and annihilated for doing exactly that, because the world wants to kill the messenger. And the more moral we are, the more attacked we are. Go figure. But that's for a different time. Our wrestling with the divine. But I now have to address this key question. And this will be brief, but it's a book that I'm writing now. I've written Kosher Sex. I've written Kosher Lust. Last year I just published a book with the actress Pamela Anderson called Lust for Love. It wasn't easy for an author and activist to write a book with an international sex symbol, but Pamela did her best, and she did a...
Pamela did her best.
At least somebody got that joke. Okay. I don't know why you're laughing. Why can't it be true?
I'm sure she did.
And I wrote Kosher Jesus. At the time, it was a very controversial book, but the book kind of presaged and predicted that evangelical Christians would emerge as arguably Israel's most dependable allies. But I'm now writing a book called Kosher Hate. And this is the essence of the book. I asked, how is it that after the Holocaust there have been so many genocides? 2 weeks ago, the United States Congress voted for the first time to recognize the Armenian genocide. It was then blocked in the Senate last week by a great friend of Israel, which is a little bit disappointing, Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. And the reason it was blocked is that Erdogan, the tyrant of Turkey, who has dismantled democracy, Turkey was the only Islamic country that had full democracy, and Erdogan has destroyed it. And he is the biggest jailer of journalists in the world. So in order not to upset Erdogan, the United States has not recognized the Armenian genocide. Israel, by the way, does not recognize the Armenian genocide, as if they could somehow placate Erdogan, who's a dyed-in-the-wool anti-Semite. But how do you have Armenians, 1916 to 1918, 2.5 million murdered? The Jews, Holocaust, 6 million. Cambodians, as we said, 2.5 million. Rwandans, 880,000. Tens of thousands in the former Yugoslavia. Darfur, 600,000. Not all. murdered in a genocide in Syria, but hundreds of thousands. How does this continue? How haven't we stopped this? How is it that someone like Jeremy Corbyn could speak about befriending Hamas? And my friends, here's the answer. It's not because, I'm going to shock you by saying this, it's not because there isn't enough love in the world. That's our mistake. We think it's because we don't love each other enough. I think it's because there isn't enough hate in the world. We have so demonized the emotion of hatred that we don't know how to hate evil. We have forgotten how to hate evil. 2,000 years ago, Jesus is quoted in the New Testament as saying, you have to love your enemies. You have to turn the other cheek to those who strike you. Luke chapter 6, verse 30. And what our Christian brothers and sisters did not understand, because those are, by the way, turn the other cheek comes from the second chapter of Lamentations. It comes from our Torah. In my book, Kosher Jesus, I show that Jesus' entire Sermon on the Mount, every verse is a requotation of something earlier in the Torah, which makes perfect sense because he was a Pharisaic rabbi. Yeah. Jesus, and ever since Jesus said that, Christians came along and said, hatred has to be purged from our heart completely. We have to love everybody. We even have to love Hitler, Osama bin Laden. We have to fight them. We have to stop them. Sometimes we have to even kill them. But we have to love even these evil, wicked men. That's not what Jesus said. Jesus never said, love God's enemy. He said, love your enemy. It's like, ve'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Your enemy is your fellow man who's not a bad person who may have offended you. The guy who steals your parking space. The guy who cuts you off on the road and there's road rage. Calm down, is what he was saying. The guy that gets your promotion at work. Don't see people as your enemy, but God's enemy? Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who the United States just killed? The head of ISIS? Do you know that this vile, wretched, repulsive abomination of a man, if you can call him a man, because he was a monster, he didn't just decapitate people and make them squeal and beg for their lives. He would rape the women so savagely before. And he promised his ISIS fighters that if they came and fought for him, they forget about waiting to get 70 virgins in heaven. They would have the right to rape women before they killed them. And he was a disgusting, vile rapist. And if you don't hate Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, then there is something wrong with your own moral compass. If you could somehow love a man like that, now you begin to understand why there's been so many genocides. We cannot summon the hatred necessary to fight the truly wicked and evil so they stop killing innocent children. You know why we are so neutral on Assad? Because all these people who say they care about Muslims and Arabs, and let's be clear, Arabs, Muslims are God's children exactly the way a Jew is. It says in the first chapter of Genesis, and we gave this to the world right at the beginning of the Torah, that God creates every human being in his image. Every human being. Jew, Gentile, agnostic, gay, straight. This isn't a political speech. This isn't someone trying to get votes. This is the Torah and the first chapter of Genesis. And Assad came along and he gassed Arab children. When he gassed, you know, I was on, again, not, I honestly don't want to be political at all, but I'm trying to share my thoughts with you. I'm on a TV show, a national TV show, a little while ago, and I'm debating the most famous imam in America. Real fine gentleman. He's actually very close to the Jewish community. Again?
Yes.
Oh, it died?
Yeah, the tape ran out.
So there was a run. Just keep going. It's not meant to be. It's
not meant to be. Debbie, no, just hold it. Debbie, just hold it. Just do it and hold it.
It's not meant to be.
Or sit there and... So I'm on a TV show. I'll delay the story. I'm on a TV show. The studio is blue. It was too hot. So I'm in this TV studio. I'm debating the man who's probably the most famous imam in America. Fine gentleman, very close to the Jewish community. And he says, Donald Trump hates Muslims. He's an Islamophobe. He tried to ban Muslims from entering America. He's disgusting. So I'm a rabbi. I try to avoid the whole political thing, unless as it applies to Israel, and the most pressing questions of human rights. So I said to him, Imam, can I respond? He said, I said, look, I just want to make one point. I said, who do you consider to have been someone who, a president who was much closer to the Islamic community, more appreciative? He said, President Obama, you know, much more than President Trump. I said, okay. I said, you know, in 2013, Bashar al-Assad dropped sarin gas on Arab children. And we all saw pictures of those children dying, gasping for air, and foaming at the mouth. And President Obama decided something has to be done. He said, this is a red line. He said, if Assad ever uses weapons of mass destruction, if he ever uses nerve agents, that's a red line. So President Obama took action. He went to someone who could be trusted to implement a human rights agenda. He went to, this is all true, you all know it to be true, he went to President Putin of Russia. And he said to him, I need you to personally guarantee that Syria is going to get rid of all their chemical weapons. And Putin said, but of course. That's me. Human rights is that's my the gematria of my name, Vladimir. So Putin removed all the chemical agents. And then Samantha Power, who was my friend, President Obama's United Nations ambassador, and John Kerry, and Susan Rice, and they all went before the world, and they said, see, America has now protected these Arab children. Putin has removed all of the... And then, of course, 2 years later, it happened again. I said, and I said to this imam, and, you know, this guy that you're saying hates Muslims, biggest Islamophobe, President Trump, who you detest, and I, you know, that's this is America. You have a right to dislike any political figure you want. But he fired all these missiles at Assad, and he said, if you gas these children again, I'm going to hit you again. So a friend of mine saw this exchange on TV, and he calls me up. He's a famous writer, and he says to me, come on, Shmuley, what Trump did was a pinprick. These 59 Tomahawk missiles, they took out a few airstrips for the Syrian Air Force. They were repaired the next day.
Did something.
I said, true. I think the American response should have been much harsher. So, but I'll tell you something. In one of the last conversations I had with Elie Wiesel, a few months before he passed away, I asked him whether he would have wanted the United States to bomb the train tracks or the Auschwitz death camp. And he said, of course. I said, but you would have died. You were 16 years old and you would have died. And he said something to me that I'll never forget. He said, I would have died, but I would have died knowing that there's justice in the world. That somebody cared. Now, this isn't a pro-Trump statement. President, absolutely far from perfect. President Obama, far from perfect. But I have to tell you, if you don't hate Assad, the reason all of this mass murder continues is that there's no kosher hate in the world. Judaism is the only religion that says that hatred is a legitimate emotion when it is expressed at the truly wicked. Ohavei Hashem, those who love God and love his children, sinura, they hate evil. That's a verse in the Psalms. And then King David himself says, Tachli sina senesim lo'ivim hayuli. I have hated the wicked with a unspeakable hatred. Lo'ivim hayuli. They are my enemy. The greatest war the United States ever fought was it wasn't even the Second World War. It was really the Civil War. The North and the South obliterating each other. 450,000 Americans died in both theaters of the Second World War. The Pacific Theater, the European Theater. That's a lot. 57,000 Americans died in Vietnam. 5,000 Americans have died in Iraq, 5,000 in Afghanistan approximately, with Afghanistan now being the longest war the United States has ever fought. But 750,000 Americans died in the Civil War. That's all of America's other wars combined. So why did Lincoln fight it? Britain voted to leave the EU. I didn't see Swedish or Norwegian or Danish tanks or French tanks invading England saying, you can't leave. So when South Carolina voted to leave the Union after Lincoln was elected president, let them go. Mississippi, Georgia, let them go. Who needs to see almost a million dead Americans? So Lincoln famously said, and let me be clear, Lincoln was clear that he was fighting first and foremost to preserve the Union and only second to abolish slavery. And he said that he would not abolish slavery if it meant he could keep the Union intact. But having said that, he always spoke of how he, quote, hated the institution of slavery. He used that word, hated. He hated slavery. Churchill, the whole of Europe was defeated, but Hitler was master of Europe, and he had no real beef with the English. He considered the English Anglo-Saxons. They were also, they were not exactly the master race, but they weren't a secondary race. They weren't like the Slavs, the Bolsheviks in Russia or Poland. He needed, his generals came to him and said to him, Führer, whatever you do, it took them a lot of courage to say this to him, whatever you do, don't do to us what the Kaiser did. Don't give us a two-front war. Don't make us fight it, you'll lose. So Hitler takes him seriously. He tries to make peace with England. First of all, to invade England's not easy. Operation Sea Lion would have meant an amphibious assault. And that was not something the Germans ever proved to be good at. So Hitler gives a famous speech in the Reichstag, which was now being held in the Kroll Opera House because the Reichstag had burned, famous fire. And Hitler gives a speech, a conciliatory speech, to Churchill and the British, saying, like, what are we fighting for? Let's come to terms. And he was prepared to offer very generous terms. And Britain had no allies left. France had capitulated, and Belgium had capitulated, and the Netherlands, everyone had capitulated. Denmark. But Churchill responded to that speech, and he said, I take your peace offer, and I throw it back in your rotten, stinking teeth. Churchill said, I hate no man but Hitler. It was hatred of evil. He saw Nazism for what it was evil, and he hated. It was a visceral response. It wasn't rational. He knew it had to be defeated. He had to hold out. Because otherwise, it really didn't make sense to hold out. When I was the rabbi at Oxford, this guy, Charmley, I forgot his first name, came out. He was a famous British historian. He came out with this best-selling book where he essentially argued that Churchill destroyed England. By being so stubborn and fighting Hitler, even though he eventually defeated him, he lost the empire. He gave Britain debts that it could almost never pay off. Britain emerges a second-rate power. And had he made peace with Hitler, he would have retained many of the colonies. Okay, so many of them would have been freed by the UN a few decades later, but Britain wouldn't have had this soaring, crazy debt. And the argument was, none of this